Chapter 12. Breaking Through Barriers to Change. In this chapter, taking a look at the fears people have about change, putting a stop to the blaming game, seeing the effects of procrastination, understanding the process of change. Lonely, empty, sad, angry, bitter, anxious, stressed, and helpless. These are the emotions that many people with borderline personality disorder, BPD, experience every day. No wonder they try to quell their pain with dissociation, thrill-seeking, self-harm, or substance abuse. Many people with BPD ache to feel better, but struggle to get the treatment they need. People with BPD, like many others, fear change. They worry that getting help for their problems will be difficult, perhaps embarrassing, and possibly even impossible. So they ask themselves, if treatment may not be successful, why take a chance in the first place? For many people, not trying at all seems better than trying and failing. Along with fear, blaming and procrastination also pose barriers to change. Searching for villains or victims shackles people in place, unable to move forward. Ignoring symptoms or putting off treatment impedes progress. This chapter describes the main obstacles that stand in the way of treatment and provides strategies for overcoming them. Tip: if you have BPD, we urge you to either buy a notebook or start an electronic document in which you take occasional notes. Write out your reactions to our ideas and carry out exercises that seem pertinent to you. Consulting these notes from time to time can greatly facilitate your progress. Ideally, you can share your notes with your therapist as the two of you collaborate on your treatment. Overcoming the fear of change. From time to time, we consult with other mental health professionals about their cases, including ones that involve BPD. Occasionally, our colleagues express concern that their clients with BPD don't really want to change. Technical stuff. You can trust mental health professionals to keep what you tell them confidential. However, sometimes they do seek supervision and consultation from colleagues. Such consultation doesn't violate confidentiality for two reasons. First, professionals don't share names and unrelated details. Second, case consultations are protected by the same rules that protect doctor-patient consultations. Furthermore, consultation enhances your therapist's ability to deliver quality treatment. In response to our colleagues' concerns about people with BPD, we ask them why they think people with BPD don't want to change. They give us several reasons, such as the following. Our client never tries any of our suggestions. Our client gets angry when we tell them to try something different. Our client says he's hopeless and that no one can help him. Our client doesn't listen to what we say. After hearing these explanations, we explain to our colleagues that these patients aren't simply being stubborn, and they certainly don't want to have BPD. So, if stubbornness doesn't explain these patients' blatant resistance to their therapist's best efforts to treat them, what does? Often, the answer is fear, more specifically, fear of change. After all, change involves taking a risk and being willing to engage in new behaviors, reactions, and ways of thinking. The following sections lay out the specific risks that people with BPD fear the most. Tip: if you have BPD, you likely have some fears about seeking out treatment and making changes in your life. These fears are normal, acceptable, and expected. If you feel your therapist is pushing you too hard to make changes, discuss your fears openly. The two of you can develop a mutual game plan for dealing with these worries at a pace that works for you. Losing who you are. It's not going to happen. Most people with BPD struggle with concerns about who they are, what they value, where they belong in the world, and what their long-term goals are about. Not infrequently, people with BPD embrace only one aspect of themselves in their self-concept, their disorder. They may not like having BPD, but they believe the diagnosis defines them. As a result of this belief, they worry that losing BPD may leave them with no identity at all. Imagine going through each day with no idea who you are or what your life is about. A pretty scary thought, right? Tip: if you have BPD and worry that getting better may leave you with no identity, try to consider the fact that treatment proceeds slowly, one step at a time. As you try on new ways of being, you can always let go of the ones you don't like. Furthermore, treatment can help you build a new identity, one that feels real and authentic to you. With treatment, you can be who you really are, not who BPD defines you to be. Opening up. No need for cold feet. When people with BPD talk about their childhoods, they often recall being scolded frequently by parents or other important people in their lives. These people told them that they shouldn't do, say, or feel what they did, said, and felt. For example, some people recall hearing the following remarks: "Stop being so nervous. You drive me crazy. Let me do that. You can't do anything right." "That's not true. You should know better. Stop that crying. You're such a baby. You have no right to be angry with your sister. What were you thinking when you did that? Obviously, you weren't." No wonder many people with BPD hesitate to open up when they begin therapy. They've been told throughout their lives that what they say, do, and feel is wrong. Tip: therapists aren't there to reenact the role played by people from childhood. Instead, they accept all feelings as valid and legitimate. Therapy can help you manage your feelings and guide you to make changes, and it does so in an atmosphere of acceptance. You can start by saying, "I feel very afraid to reveal the real me to you." Your therapist will likely say something reassuring or accepting in response. Dreading even more loss. Don't test the ones who want to help. Most people with BPD experienced loss, trauma, abuse, or neglect during childhood. As adults, the unstable moods and impulsivity they developed in childhood may lead to losses of friends, family, and lovers. As a result, they look at new relationships with a combination of fear and hope. They crave closeness, yet expect abandonment. Starting treatment involves engaging a therapeutic relationship with another person, which can be an extremely frightening concept for someone who has been part of countless hurtful relationships. To protect against feared abandonment, people with BPD often misbehave in social situations. They feel that rejecting is better than being rejected. Therefore, they test the limits and patience of people who try to help them to make sure they do the hurting, not the other way around. People with BPD most often test the relationships they have with significant others and therapists. See chapters 21 and 25 for information you need to know if you're the partner or a therapist of someone with BPD. Tip: ask your therapist directly whether he thinks that you engage in testing at particular times. Listen carefully and try to look out for this pattern in future sessions. Fearing treatment. Don't let therapy myths hold you back. When we meet new people and tell them what we do for a living, we often get a plethora of questions about whether or not we can read minds. Well, unfortunately, we can't, although the idea is sometimes appealing. Mind reading is just one of the many myths about psychology and psychotherapy. Unfortunately, some of these myths stop people from pursuing therapy. Don't let the following therapy myths stop you from proceeding with treatment. Therapy trivializes problems. Some people believe that therapists make light of deep, complicated issues when they ask their patients to make changes. These people may have experienced horrific abuse or trauma, and think that being asked to change trivializes the meaning of these events. If you feel diminished or trivialized in this way, consider telling your therapist how you feel. Good therapists strive to listen and understand the full impact of their patients' painful experiences. They will work with you on a gradual plan for change that enables you to feel appreciated, accepted, and respected. Therapy can't give me everything I need. Actually, this myth isn't a complete myth. Therapy can't give you everything you need. No one person on earth can meet another person's full list of needs. The myth in this belief, however, is in believing that you must have all your needs met all the time. The real role of therapists is to help you find ways to meet your needs more often than you have met them in the past. Therapy doesn't work. Some people buy into this myth because they've been to therapy and haven't experienced success, or because they've seen a friend or loved one go to therapy without any obvious benefit. However, hundreds of studies have shown that therapy does work for a wide range of problems. And studies in the past several decades have provided convincing evidence that therapy can reduce BPD symptoms. Keep in mind, however, that not every type of therapy has demonstrated effectiveness for BPD, but a number of them have. See Chapter 11 for information about which kinds of therapy work best for treating BPD. Therapists can't possibly understand me. Some people worry that their problems are so deep and complex that no one can fully understand them. This myth also contains a grain of truth. No one can connect with and appreciate every single facet of your issues 100% of the time. However, therapists have spent years in training and practice, listening carefully to people as they explain their feelings, histories, and pain. Your therapist may understand you in a way that you haven't experienced previously. Therapists will ask me to do things I can't do. The fact that therapists do indeed suggests that you attempt various new ways of thinking and behaving fuels this myth. However, if you feel unable to follow a suggestion, talk about it with your therapist. Ethical therapists never ask people to do what they're not prepared to do. Tip: if you have BPD, write down any of your concerns about therapy and treatment in your notebook and take them to your therapist to discuss. Try to be open to the idea that your therapist wants to help. Looking at fears of change in action. The following story about Alexis illustrates how someone with BPD may refuse treatment because of a few misconceptions and fears. Alexis worries about losing her identity, feeling worse as a result of treatment, failing after trying to get better, and opening up to someone new. Alexis wakes up dizzy, uncomfortable, and groggy. Head pounding, she tries to roll over, but straps tie her wrists and ankles to the hospital bed. "Nurse! Nurse! Help me!" she yells. She remembers little of the night before. She had a huge fight with her husband, Aaron, and she thinks she may have taken too much pain medicine. A woman with a white coat and badge enters the room. "Good morning, Alexis. How are you feeling?" "Like crap," Alexis replies. "Get these stupid straps off. Who are you?" "I'm your psychologist while you're here. My name is Dr. Rachel Hunter. Do you remember what happened last night?" "I know I was furious with my husband. That lazy, good-for-nothing piece of trash. He hasn't worked for months. He sits on his butt and watches reality shows on the television while I work extra shifts just to see our credit cards get overdrawn because he's eating popcorn all day." Alexis speaks quickly and continues without pausing. "I stand on my feet all day, and they hurt like hell. So I was so mad that I probably took some extra pills to get to sleep. When I get mad at him, I get so worked up that I can't sleep. Then I have to get up and go to work, and I'm screwed." "Alexis, you took about 10 times the normal dosage of your pain medicine. You were unconscious when your husband found you. When you got to the hospital, you became combative. You were pretty violent. We put the restraints on for your safety," Dr. Hunter explains. "You know, This is your third hospitalization this year for overdosing. The last two times you checked yourself out of the hospital against medical advice. As you know, we believe that you have a disorder called borderline personality disorder. We're very concerned about your going home without getting some help first. Would you consider talking about a program we have here at the hospital? Many people who work through the program feel better and are better able to cope with the world. Look, doctor, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm mad at my husband, my marriage is a failure, and I work too hard. I've gone to counselors before and nothing changed. I don't think I can change, and I'm not going to waste my time for nothing. I don't need to fail at something else. I just need to get off my butt and lose the loser. So, Alexis, it sounds like you're worried that you may not benefit from this program, and that to get better, you've just got to leave your husband. No wonder you don't want to stay. Let's keep talking while I get these restraints off. I can tell that you're calm. Dr. Hunter begins to loosen the straps around Alexis' wrists. Thanks, that feels better. Alexis shakes her hands. You know, I have developed a pretty tough exterior to keep myself going. I always go to work. I have to go to work. And I try not to let others see how horrible my life is. So I worry that if I start some kind of treatment, I'll just melt away and dissolve. I know that sounds crazy, but I'm scared to get help. I think it will make me worse. As much as I hate my husband, I'm afraid of living without him. Dr. Hunter explains how treatment really works, and she helps Alexis see that a few misconceptions about therapy are stopping her from getting the help she needs. Alexis's concerns and worries about therapy are legitimate and completely understandable. However, Dr. Hunter helps her decide that treatment is worth the risk. Alexis's therapy will require some time, but it's also likely to teach her how to set better limits with her husband and how to deal with her own emotions in less self-destructive ways. Taking charge and giving up the victim role. People search for answers to why bad things happen to them. They try to discover who or what is to blame. In the same way, many people who have BPD want to know why they have the disorder and whom they can blame for it. Unfortunately, this search for a guilty party usually ends up causing more harm than good. No single cause is responsible for BPD, and no one person is to blame. See Chapter 4 for information about the multitude of causes. In addition, people with traumatic histories often respond to BPD by feeling helpless and hopeless. These feelings lead them to adopt the role of a sick person or a victim. Although these roles have a few advantages, they inevitably handcuff people in their hopeless, helpless states of mind. Ending the blame game. Most people with BPD can recount numerous negative episodes from their childhoods that caused them pain, distress, disgust, or angst. As they comb through a series of such episodes, sometimes they blame themselves for what happened to them. For example, when children experience abuse, they typically see themselves as deserving the abuse. As a result, their self-esteem disintegrates and they learn to loathe the very essence of their beings. Unfortunately, many people with BPD cling to this same belief that they somehow cause their own misfortunes and possibly even their BPD. Tip: if you engage in the self-loathing, blaming game, consider listening to Chapter 4 to understand the multiple causes of BPD. If a girl tells you she's being abused, what do you tell her? Do you blame and defame her? Probably not. Consider taking the same perspective for yourself. Write your thoughts about how you blame yourself in your notebook, and think about how some of the things you blame yourself for aren't your fault. On the other hand, many people with BPD blame other people for their current distress. They play and replay scenes in their minds in which others tormented and hurt them. Although much of the blame may be pointed in the right direction, replaying these scenes does little more than re-traumatize. Tip: when you find yourself blaming others for your troubles, try to step back. Remind yourself that blame just digs a hole. Give yourself 5 minutes each day to blame others, and then focus on something else. If you repeat the 5-minute exercise every day for a while, you'll likely find yourself tiring of the blame game. Technical stuff. One legitimate treatment strategy does involve replaying past traumatic experiences. However, this treatment, often called imaginal exposure or flooding, needs to occur in conditions carefully controlled by a highly trained therapist. We generally don't recommend attempting this technique on your own. Thinking like a victim. It doesn't do you any good. When you have a fever, going to bed and resting usually helps your body fight off whatever is causing the illness. If you're sick with something more severe than a low fever, you may have to go to a hospital, where a team of healthcare professionals can take care of you. Because BPD is a kind of emotional illness, part of you probably wants to go to bed and let others take care of you. However, for the most part, treating BPD takes active participation from you, the person who has BPD. Warning. When BPD causes someone to want to hurt himself or others, a hospital setting may indeed be necessary. During situations like these, when someone is at risk of physical injury or death, a team of healthcare professionals may provide the best and most appropriate care. Thinking like a victim involves believing that you're dependent, sick, and incapable of helping yourself. Victims feel that their problems are especially overwhelming and often complain to others about them. Victims bemoan that their suffering isn't their fault. And, in fact, it isn't. But victims hurt themselves with their own victimhood because feeling like a victim does nothing to inspire positive change. At first, victims may indeed receive extra attention and help. Other people feel sorry for them and are motivated to try to alleviate their suffering, which is one advantage of taking on the role of victim. However, other people eventually find themselves burning out because they repeatedly try to help but have little to no success. Victims are so entrenched in their helplessness that they can't, or won't, allow anything or anyone to help them. Over time, thinking like a victim leads to a passive acceptance of BPD for both the helpers and the sufferers. Meaningful change comes when the sufferer finds forgiveness and learns to start coping. Finding forgiveness and coping. Anger can be a useful emotion. It generates energy and focuses attention. Anger increases the body's ability to respond to danger. However, when you're angry about something in the past, your attention and energy focus solely on the past. As a result, you can't move forward. When you have experienced trauma, feeling angry at the person or people you believe hurt you is perfectly natural. However, you need to realize that your anger shackles you to your past. You get stuck in the middle of the old trauma. Sometimes people with BPD believe that forgiving somehow means admitting that what happened to them was acceptable. However, learning to let go isn't saying that what happened was okay. It's saying that you're willing to heal. Tip. If you're struggling with BPD, try to understand that although you're not to blame for your BPD, you are responsible for making the changes you want in your life. See chapters 15 through 20 for lots of ideas about how to make those changes. Stop procrastinating. Most people put off doing things they fear or see as especially difficult. Perhaps you have put off looking into therapy for years because you fear that therapy will hurt more than help. Or you start therapy, but can't seem to get anywhere with it. Your brain likely manufactures excuses for not pursuing therapy faster than the United States Mint stamps out coins. The following sections take a look at some of the more problematic excuses and how to beat them back. Dismantling excuses. People create excuses to avoid addressing problems that seem larger than they can handle. Excuses, some people would call them lies, are like stories we create to promote procrastination. Quite often, these stories seem believable. Therefore, before you can move forward, you have to learn how to see through your mind's excuses to recognize the lies behind them. Tip: consider titling a page of your notebook, Excavating and Demolishing Excuses. Jot down your mind's reasons why you should put off tackling your problems. Then come up with an argument with a more realistic perspective to demolish your excuses. Here are a few questions you can ask yourself to develop some excuse busters of your own. What would I tell a friend who used my excuse? Will staying where I'm at get me where I want to go? Is part of my excuse simply not true? If you have trouble coming up with excuse busters, or if you don't think you're making excuses, but you are putting off treatment, you're not a lost cause. Listen to more of this book and see whether you start feeling a little differently after a while. Debating the decision. Another technique that can loosen the hold procrastination has on you is called a cost-benefit analysis, a technique psychologists have been using for decades. The beauty of a cost-benefit analysis is that it's fairly easy and straightforward, and also surprisingly effective at the same time. You can use a cost-benefit analysis to tackle almost anything that has you stuck. For this reason, we use this technique in several chapters of this book. A cost-benefit analysis provides a great way to combat procrastination because procrastination almost always stirs up ambivalent feelings. Part of you sees the advantages or benefits of moving ahead with treatment, while part of you fears the costs or disadvantages of starting treatment. A cost-benefit analysis lets you objectively view these conflicting thoughts and feelings side by side. The following example of Lucas describes how a cost-benefit analysis can help convince someone that treatment is worth a shot, even when he's been refusing it for years. Lucas speeds through an intersection well after the yellow light turns red. Horns and squealing brakes accompany the crash. A pickup truck broadsides his car on the passenger's side. His red compact car takes the full impact of the crash and veers into oncoming traffic. A minivan stopped at the light can't get out of the way. Lucas's red car slams into the front of the minivan, triggering its airbags. By this time, the driver of the pickup leaps out of his vehicle, shaking and swearing at Lucas. "What the hell? You ran a red light. What's wrong with you?" The woman slides out from behind her airbag, screaming that she just dropped off her kids at school. Blood drips from her forehead. Lucas slumps in his totaled car, not speaking. Soon, police and paramedics arrive on the scene. Lucas slurs his words and smells like alcohol. He has an open container of beer in the cup holder next to his seat, and the air in the car smells like marijuana. After checking for injuries, the police arrest Lucas. This accident is his third in 1 year, and this arrest is his fourth one for driving under the influence. In jail, Lucas reluctantly agrees to a psychological evaluation. He is diagnosed with alcohol dependence, cannabis, marijuana, abuse, and BPD. The judge orders mandated inpatient drug treatment in a secure facility. Lucas is only 20 years old, and the judge wants to give him a chance. The police transport Lucas from the jail to the rehab site. He refuses to speak to anyone, fights with the staff, and ends up in isolation. After a week or so, a therapist approaches him again. Lucas, bored by his isolation, agrees to meet. They sit together in a small room with a one-way mirror. The therapist asks Lucas whether he is willing to discuss all the reasons why he doesn't want to get treatment. Lucas quickly agrees, eager to show the therapist why he doesn't need to go to therapy. Together, they begin a cost-benefit analysis. This is the first time Lucas takes a reasoned look at the costs and benefits of his treatment avoidance. Lucas and his therapist talk about the cost-benefit analysis. For the first time, Lucas begins to see where his life may go if he doesn't make some changes. Lucas agrees to start working with an individual therapist, and after a few sessions, he agrees to begin group therapy. He also agrees to talk to a psychiatrist about medication that may help him with his urges to drink. This simple technique helps people see what thoughts are preventing them from going forward with treatment. For instance, most of the time, people fear failure, embarrassment, and change. Looking at the costs of giving into these fears and staying in one place can be a catalyst for progressing to the next stage. You can use the following steps to create your own cost-benefit analysis for delaying treatment for your BPD. 1. On a page in your notebook, write down cost-benefit analysis of not seeking treatment. 2. Make two columns underneath the title. Label the first one Benefits and the second one Costs. 3. In the Benefits column, write down all the reasons why staying the same and not getting treatment are good for you. These reasons can include not having to change what you like about your current situation, not having to experience the pain of change, not having to open up to someone, and not having to pay the costs, personal, financial, and time, of treatment. 4. In the costs column, write down all the ways that not getting help and treatment may cost you both in the short run and in the long run. Consider including how BPD is hurting you, how BPD is hurting your family and friends, and how BPD can even hurt innocent bystanders. 5. Write out a few thoughts and reflections about the costs and benefits you've come up with, if you want to. Think about the relative pluses and minuses of seeking treatment, and if you're already working with a therapist, discuss your results. Getting comfortable with the process of change. Starting treatment can feel like a tough and risky decision. You don't know what to expect, and you worry that you may not get better. This section takes a look at the process of change and how you can get comfortable with it. Change takes time, and progress varies. Do you remember learning to ride a bike as a child? You started out with a lot of help. Either training wheels or a person had to hold you up or you fell over. Gradually, you learned to balance on two wheels with support. Then the training wheels came off or the person let go. For a second or two, you were on your own. Balanced for only a short time, the wheels started to wobble and you needed some extra help again. Learning to ride a bike takes most kids repeated trials and a lot of falls. For some kids, the balancing is too scary and too difficult. They may give up only to try again in a few months or even a year. A few kids have so much trouble that they never learn to ride a bike. But fortunately, most kids stick with it long enough to learn how to ride without support. The common saying that once you learn how to ride a bike, you never forget, is true. Even so, most adults who haven't been on a bike since childhood start out slowly with a little fear, but they quickly regain their skills. Getting help for BPD, like most of life's problems, is a lot like learning to ride a bike. At first, you need a lot of support. You may fail and fall quite a bit in the beginning. You may even give up for a while. But most people who stick with either bike riding or psychotherapy eventually gain skills and balance. They certainly wobble from time to time and even fall off occasionally, but with repeated practice, the skills become second nature to them. Like riding a bike, after you learn how to face your problems, you never forget. Sure, you may be frightened and start out slowly, but with a little support, you can get right back up again.